Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for you today. Emily Jackson, the founder and director of Growing Minds, which is a program of the Appalachian Sustainable Agricultural Project. She'll be joining me on the show in just a little bit. But first, I want to share with you some things going on in my life, in the news, and of course, share my weekly recipe with you. So this week, on my Zoom class, I made a Georgian radish green pate. And when I say Georgian, not the state Georgian, but the country, the Republic of Georgia. There, they use beet greens and radish greens to make these wonderful pates. And as we've all become more aware of food waste and not throwing parts of the vegetable away and trying to use the whole vegetable, I have developed these pates using the tops of vegetables. And they've really been great. And my Zoom classes have been going really well, although I have to say the numbers have been declining. And I think that's partly because the weather's been so beautiful and people are outside. And also people are resuming some social gathering, even though we're still practicing distancing and being safe. So people are getting busy. So next week is going to be my last Zoom class for now, unless I get demand to bring them back. But I've been offering them for free, and they've been really wonderful. I've been doing them since April. And this week I focused on appetizers. Next week I'm actually going to do vegan desserts. So we will be making a vegan lemon raspberry cheesecake and some vegan Linzer tarts, which are little cookies with a jam center. And I'll probably throw in something else, too. I'm not sure. We'll see what the timing is. So if you haven't joined any of the Zoom classes yet, I highly recommend you do, since this will be the last one. They are all being posted on my website as well under recipes and Zoom classes. So you can find those on my website at iegreen.com. And we have all been, you know, watching and hopefully participating in the Black Lives Matter movement. It is really wonderful to see such a cross-section of the population out there supporting and standing in solidarity with our communities of color. And it is high time for this to really happen. Of course, we all were hopeful when President Obama was elected, and it didn't materialize. There were just too many Republicans in power that tried to squash everything that he was trying to do that was good. And that continues today. The dismantling of the Clean Water Act and Environmental Protection Agency and all the good things that they try to do, healthcare, you know, the people in the current administration are doing everything they can to undo it. So we really need to elect a Democrat to office. I try not to get too political, but I just heard that Joe Biden has selected Larry Summers as his economic advisor. And Larry Summers is not the person we want, and it's certainly not setting an example of Joe Biden's judgment and who he's going to choose to be around him and be his advisors. Larry Summers is responsible for saying that developing countries should bear the brunt of toxic waste because poor people produce less economic value. Bull. I can't say it on the air. Bull. That is not right. He's also said that there's biological differences between men and women, and that's why more women are not going into science and math, that they don't have the women don't have the same mindset and capabilities in science and math that men do. We know that's not true. He also pushed to deregulate Wall Street, leading to the financial crisis of 2008, and he's supported the Keystone XL pipeline, which I have been fighting for years, even got arrested down in D.C. while protesting with Bill McKibben to squash that project. So this is not the man that we want Joe Biden getting advice from when it comes to our economic future here in this country. So there is a petition on my website, and I'm asking all of you to please sign it, spread it, the word. We need to let Joe Biden know that this is not the path we want him to go in. And if he's, you know, we don't have much choice when it comes to who we're going to be electing to defeat Trump, even though there was a big lineup of Democratic candidates at the beginning, we're down to really one. So please sign this petition and let our one candidate, our one Democratic candidate, Joe Biden, know that we need him to choose progressive, anti-racist, environmentally conscious people to advise him. One thing that was good in the news this week is that the federal court has banned Monsanto's dicamba pesticide, which is a toxic pesticide, has been linked to so many health issues, and this will help protect farmers, our health, and lots of endangered species who also die from eating this. Also, one of the problems with dicamba is the drift. When you spray it, it just flies all over the place. So any farmers in adjacent fields who choose not to spray still are getting this pesticide on their crops, especially organic farmers, and it ruins their livelihood. So this was a great big win for food advocates, healthy food advocates. And yet, it's really unbelievable because in the face of the federal court ruling, the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is choosing to ignore the rule. They're choosing to fight it, and they're telling farmers, go ahead and keep spraying until you use up everything that you have in your stockpile. So, you know, follow this news. It's really disturbing. It's just unbelievable that this is still going on. So the Environmental Protection Agency is, you know, our agency that's supposed to be protecting us, and they are just not doing a job, especially during this pandemic. They have been looking the other way. All any polluter has to do, any corporate polluter has to do, is say COVID-19 is preventing me from regulating the regulations or following the regulations, and they can get away with dumping into the river. I just got an email from Riverkeeper, which is the Hudson River's protecting green nonprofit, that polluters are now dumping into the river again. We've spent years and years cleaning up the Hudson River, and we can't give them a green light to just keep dumping. So, you know, check out the River Keeper's website at what you can do there. And let's just all, you know, really step up to the plate and let our voices be heard. We can't all do everything, but we all can do something. And that's my motto. And so we all need to do our part to make this world better and to unseat the current administration. So I do want to share with you my weekly recipe. Actually, yesterday in my Zoom cooking class, I made four recipes. I made the Georgian radish green pate that I'm going to share with you today and an avocado mango sushi roll, and I'll share that. I also made another vegetarian sushi roll, which is a roll that I actually learned to make almost 40 years ago when I was a vegetarian chef at one of the first vegetarian restaurants in Greenwich Village called Arnold's Turtle. And I learned to make these vegetarian sushi rolls there. They actually serve them hot at the restaurant. I usually serve them cold, but they're really great hot too. And then I also shared my hummus recipe. Hummus is one of the easiest things to whip up, and it's just amazing how hummus has become so popular and people are just buying this hummus. And the hummus you buy really does not have that much flavor. If you buy hummus at the store, I recommend adding a little bit more garlic, adding a little cumin powder, adding some cilantro, something to give those store-bought hummuses more flavor. But I will have my recipes up on my website so that you can find them. But right now I'm just going to share the Georgian radish green pate with you for time's sake. So the radish cream pate, again, is using the tops of radishes. And I used about three bunches of radishes yesterday in order to get enough tops. Normally, I'm growing radishes, and I'm growing radishes. They're just not all in yet, big enough for me to use the tops. So I bought three bunches of radishes, and when you steam them, it comes out to about 2 cups of radish green steamed, and that's what you want. You're going to steam the radish greens, and you're going to squeeze the water out of them and measure them and come to the recipe with 2 cups of steamed radish greens. If you don't have enough radish greens, you can add beet greens, you can add arugula, you can add any type of spicy Asian greens, but the idea is that the greens that you're using are a little spicy and, vibrant. So 2 cups of steamed radish greens or other, 1 cup of walnuts, 6 cloves of garlic, 1/2 cup of cilantro, and if you don't like cilantro, you can add parsley to this instead, although it will change the flavor. If you like cilantro, this is a great dish for you. 2 tablespoons olive oil, 1/2 cup of red onion. Yesterday I didn't have red onion. I used white onion. You can use whichever. It's really fine. 1 shallot chopped, 1 stalk of celery chopped, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon pepper, 1 teaspoon of Kumili Sunili spice mix. Now, Kumili Sunili spice mix is a traditional spice mix like chili powder or curry powder, but this is in Georgia. So you can find it online. I put a link on my recipe to this spice, but just Google it in Amazon. It's spelled KHMELISUNELI. And again, it's on my website too. But this is a great spice. If you don't have it, you can add some more cardamom or fenugreek. Those are some of the main ingredients in that spice mixture. I also add another 1/2 teaspoon of cardamom, 1/2 teaspoon of cumin, and then 1/4 cup of olive oil for this recipe. So you start by steaming the radish greens. And then you want to, as soon as they come out, you want to either put them into a cold bath or just run them under cold water to stop the cooking. And you want to steam them just really lightly till they wilt. The idea is that you want them to remain bright green color. If you overcook them, they turn an olive green, and the color of the pate just will not be beautiful. And you're going to squeeze out all the water from the radish greens. You're going to saute the onions and the shallots in the 2 tablespoons of olive oil until they're translucent and golden or caramelized a bit. Add the parsley and continue cooking for about another 5 minutes. And then you're going to use a food processor, and you're going to pulse the radish tops until they're blended. Add the garlic, the walnuts, and then the sauteed onions, celery, and shallot. To that, add the cilantro as well, and keep pulsing it and wiping down the sides of the food processor until all of it's blended smoothly together. And I leave a little bit of texture. I don't make it completely smooth, so you have a little bit of you can feel a little bit of the nuts and the greens in there. And then you add all the spices, salt and pepper, and mix it up some more. Then slowly you're going to drizzle through the pour spout the olive oil while the food processor is running. And this is going to emulsify the olive oil and make the whole pate come together and be creamy. And then taste it and adjust the spices to your particular taste. You can add more cumin or cardamom, more cilantro, more salt, however you like it. And I serve it with either tortilla chips, pita chips, rice crackers, and, of course, vegetable crudité is also great being served with this. So enjoy that recipe. And then the other recipe I wanted to share with you is the avocado mango sushi rolls. And these are really beautiful rolls, and they resemble, you know, when you get sushi rolls that have fish on top of them, it kind of resembles that. I actually didn't cut the or slice the mango as thin as one could. But you can actually slice the mango so thin that it looks like lox and just lay it on top of the nori rolls and cut it that way. But I actually cut mine a little into little thicker slices yesterday in the class. But you want to start with one package of pre-toasted nori. And nori is the seaweed sheets that sushi is made from. And you can get them pre-toasted, which means that they're ready to roll. If you get nori that is not pre-toasted, you can actually just hold it over the flame of your stove and lightly toast it, and that will be good too. 2 cups of organic short grain brown rice already cooked. 2 avocados, 2 mangoes, and that really 1 avocado, 1 mango, depending on how many rolls you're going to make, also works. Pomegranate seeds, 1 tablespoon of molasses, pomegranate molasses, and 1 tablespoon of tamari, and you're going to mix those together just to make a little paste that you're going to seal the nori rolls with. And then you also want to have some aji mirin on hand, because we'll make a dipping sauce with the tamari and the mirin together. And mirin is a sweet rice wine. And I just want to warn you that Kikkoman, which is a very famous brand that makes soy sauce, they also make a mirin. But if you look at the ingredients there, even though they sell it at Whole Foods, and I've complained many times, it's really just glucose syrup, which is not what mirin's supposed to be. It's supposed to be sweet rice and koji, which is another seaweed, and water, and that's it. So buy Eden brand Aji Mirin. It's really the best one out there. So you're going to start by cutting the avocados into thin strips and the mango into thin strips. And on the Zoom cooking class, I show you how to do that as well. Lay out the nori sheet so that the long edge of the rectangle is facing you. Spread 1 cup of cooked rice over the sheet of nori, leaving 3/4 of an inch of exposed nori at the top without any rice. And lightly wet your hands, and you're going to press the rice down onto the sheet of nori really hard, and use your opposite hand as a guide so that you can press the nori all the way to the very edge of the sheet of nori. And you're going to press it down so hard that you can actually lift the sheet of nori up and the rice will stick to the nori. And the idea there is so that when you roll the roll up, it really is firm all the way to the edge so that the pieces on the edge don't just fall apart. So then you're going to lay out the strips of avocado horizontally down the middle of the sheet of nori. Then you're going to add a line of pomegranate seeds on top of the avocado. And then you are going to make a little mixture in a little bowl with the pomegranate molasses and the tamari. And you're going to start rolling the sushi roll, starting at the edge that's closest to your body. Roll it up over the avocado and pomegranate seeds, and continue rolling, pressing as you roll so that the sushi roll is tight. And then you're going to seal it with that pomegranate molasses and roll it all the way up until it seals tightly. Then you're going to add the slices of mango on top. And yesterday I added them on top, but they were falling off as I was cutting it. So I actually decided that you can just cut the sushi rolls first and then add a slice of mango to each individual piece of sushi. And since they're lying on top, you can't serve the sushi on its side, which is very often with my other sushi rolls, they lie them on their sides so you can see the center and the decoration of the center. These I serve standing up so that the mango is just lying right on top. And they're really beautiful. It's a beautiful presentation. And these sushi rolls, you can really think of the nori and the rice as a vehicle for almost anything. I remember when we were pescatarian, we actually ate fish. You could actually put tuna salad in there and avoid eating bread if you didn't want to eat the gluten, or any of my leftover stir fries. My leftover dinner from the night before, I can put inside that nori and roll it up. It's really so flexible and accommodating that it's a great vehicle for just about anything. So experiment with nori rolls. They're really fun. And now it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest today. Emily Jackson is the founder and director of Gene Sustainable Agricultural Projects Growing Minds Farm to School Program. And Growing Minds is one of the first farm-to-school programs in the country and a pioneer in farm-to-early childcare education as well. Emily served as the National Farm-to-School Network's Southeast Regional Lead for 9 years and currently co-facilitates the North Carolina Farm-to-Preschool Network. She lives in the beautiful mountains of Western North Carolina with her husband, her dog, and her 2 cats, and she also raises chickens. And she's hoping to write a children's book and believes deeply that every child should have the opportunity to grow a garden. And I couldn't agree with her more. And as a fellow farm-to-school educator, I'm thrilled to introduce you all to Emily Jackson. Emily, you with me?
I am. I'm just delighted to be here.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for joining me. I've been checking out your website, and you know what you're doing there is just really great. I thought maybe I know I've shared with my listening audience before about Farm to School, since I am the Farm to School coordinator for New York State in a local school district here on Long Island. But I thought you could share your perspective of Farm to School and Farm to Preschool, since your program also focuses on preschool.
Sure. Well, my program, which is part of ASAP, you mentioned Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project, we define farm to school and farm to preschool as basically having four components. And so we see those as being edible gardens, farmer field trips, or, you know, field trips out to farms, or the farm visits the classroom, locally grown food served in meals or snacks, and then cooking with local food in the classroom. So the preschool age, you know, you just have to shift it to, like in North Carolina, they're not allowed to prepare a meal where they all put things in a communal pot, so they have to make their own food for that only they will consume. So you just have to kind of know the parameters in the early childhood world to kind of finesse the farm to school programming.
Uh-huh. And how long has your program been going on?
We started in 2002. I was a former classroom teacher and had always wanted to grow a garden with children. And the school where I taught was in a rural community in Western North Carolina. And I realized really quickly that even though we were surrounded by farms, my children didn't understand how food was grown or who grew it or, you know, anything about the process. And so I started a garden with my then third graders. And then in the second year, I was in second grade, and all the teachers in second grade joined me in providing gardens for all of our kids.
Uh-huh. And so was the Appalachian Sustainable Agricultural Project already in existence when you started the farm-to-school program, or did the farm-to-school program start first and then the Appalachian Sustainable Agricultural Project grow around that?
We grew into the Appalachian Sustainable Agriculture Project. It was already in existence, and I wrote a little grant to ASAP to fund worm bins for all the second grade classrooms. And then we wrote a grant to a community foundation. And then I left the classroom to take this to schools across Western North Carolina and the Southern Appalachians.
Wow. What first inspired you? Just starting the garden, and then it just naturally grew from there?
It did start with the garden, but I just saw how children responded to it. I saw the almost limitless educational opportunities that I could use the garden for to teach. You know, I am hard pressed to come up with anything that I can't figure out a way to teach with a garden. And then I heard my children. You know, I was a relatively new teacher, and I heard my children saying, why aren't we, serve beets in our cafeteria? And, you know, they were eating all of the things that they were growing. But I'd always heard children didn't eat, you know, healthy foods. They didn't eat fruits and vegetables. I wasn't really thinking about their health, but I realized suddenly that, you know, I was going to be improving their health by having them work in the garden to grow their own food, really helped provide that positive experience with healthy food that I think every child needs in order to, you know, bring them around to wanting to eat the fruits and vegetables.
Uh-huh. Right. So what other services and resources do you provide to schools and preschools? And how many schools are you currently working with?
Well, our basic premise is that we work really hard to create trainings and resources for schools and preschools so that they can, with minimal help from us, implement it on their own. So we've been doing this 18 plus years, and so there's just hundreds, if not thousands, of schools that are using our resources and have attended our conferences and our workshops and who apply for mini grants, who come in and get free seeds in the spring and fall. So it's we do trainings and workshops, you know, on a pretty regular basis to bring in more people. But then there's we have this huge backlog of folks who, not backlog, but a lot of folks who through the years have just been, you know, steadily incorporating this, you know, into their curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And we started working with preschools in 2007 because we were approached by a Head Start agency who wanted, they'd done their research on the food that they'd like to see in their food service, and they were actually interested in getting organic food. And then, so we talked to them about how we could connect them with local farmers. But then we ended up working with their teachers to help them learn how to use taste tests and cooking and gardening and farm field trips as instructional tools.
Uh-huh. And do you work directly, do you have farmers that come into the school as well to talk to the students, or do you mostly bring the students to the farms?
In the preschool world, we tend to bring the farmer to the students because it's just a little, you know, harder to get preschoolers out there. We make those connections or help them make those connections, and then we provide some funding so that they can pay the farmer for their time to come into the classroom or either to host a farmer's market. But in COVID times, you know, children aren't being able to go to farms or have the farm come to the classroom. So we're creating a video series of, we're calling it Meet Your Farmer. And so we work with over 800 Appalachian grown farms. That's a certification that my organization does. And so we're going to create these videos so that we can post them online and children and their families can see, you know, the vast array, not only of the farmers themselves, but of all the products that they grow and raise.
And do you have that video series already up and running, or you're working on that?
We're just working on it because, you know, this is something we just landed upon, you know, in the last couple of months. We have had our first farmer submit his raw data, his raw footage, and so we're going to work with him to, you know, really create a really nice short video. But he'll be our first. It's Wesley Slate with Slate Family Farms.
Uh-huh. Wonderful. Wonderful. And will other school districts be able to share that as well? Because right now you should know that I have shared your day-by-day online lessons with my listening audience and in my newsletter because it's just wonderful to give parents and educators this direction because so many people, you know, overnight, you know, parents became teachers and they're homeschooling and they have to keep their kids busy. And so many of the tips that you give of, you know, whether it's, you know, to start a garden or to, you know, some of the tips you give are just really, really helpful for parents.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we just released our latest iteration of that. We're going to do that for the foreseeable future. And I'm glad you appreciated it for the, you know, we made this with caregivers and parents in mind because they were suddenly burdened with the education of their children, especially the young children. And it was a lot of fun to put together, actually, to have a theme and come up with recipes and read-alouds and activities, you know, around that theme. It's actually been a lot of fun to put together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like the theme of the bees and the pollinators. You know, kids love butterflies, and also just to try to dismantle their fear around bees and how important bees are, and to love bees is a wonderful thing to share with the kids, because, you know, so often they see a bee and they just run the other way. And to know that bees, you know, don't go on the attack, you know. They're different than wasps and hornets.
But, of course. You know, good to teach them the difference.
Absolutely, absolutely. So what have been some of the day-to-day experiences, you know, that you have, that you found most successful in this series that you've been putting online? And, you know, and also I just have to say I've so impressed with, you know, you and so many people out there, how you've adjusted to the COVID quarantine situation. It's not been easy for any of us, you know, especially when your lessons are geared towards hands-on.
Exactly. That was a real challenge. And then we worried about, you know, we focus a lot of our resources on children's literature, because that's a usually a sweet spot for a teacher, you know, to enter into Growing Minds, is using this to uplift their language arts program. And so then we were like, oh, but now children aren't in school and they may not have the books. And so finding, and we didn't even realize this existed, but we found all of these, you know, kids and librarians and authors reading the books aloud. And so being able to incorporate that into our day-by-days has been great.
Tell me where that is so I can share that, because that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, we usually have a read aloud in each week in each iteration. In fact, this last week, our day-by-day, the theme was squash. And so we have a book about this little boy, and that we have someone reading the book. They read it in English, and then you can listen to it in Spanish as well.
Really? That is great. That is great, because I know quite a few people also, you know, one of my daughter's friends' parents, they send their kids to a bilingual school, but the parents don't know Spanish, and all of a sudden the kid's home and they're having to help their kid with Spanish lessons, and they don't even know how to do that. So,
And we also, you know, we give away seeds in the spring and fall for free to schools and preschools, but, you know, with COVID, we had to figure out how to do that in a different way, and so, you know, a lot of school systems and different people are doing food meals, you know, grab-and-go meals for school systems. And so we purchased 2,500 packs of seeds from this international seed program, and made those available to 1,000 families, kids and families, through those feeding sites and Head Start centers that we work with. You know, so we then, knowing that we put those seeds out there in the world, we're, you know, trying to develop resources that help the families who now have those seeds and hopefully are growing a nice, healthy, lovely garden.
Now, are the packs of seeds a mixture of seeds, or is each pack is one type of seed?
We made packets, so with three different types of seeds for the garden. Usually, you know, pre-COVID, teachers and parents and stuff would come in, and they would just select the seeds they wanted. So they may leave with, you know, 10 or 15 types of seeds. But for this project, we had the 3,000 packs, because Slow Food Asheville also gave us 500 packs of an heirloom okra. And so we included those in it. So we had 3,000 packs that we then made into 1,000 packets. And we put information about how to grow the garden and how to maybe save your own seed and things like that. And that was really fun to get out there in the world.
That's wonderful. Emily, we're going to take a couple-minute break. And when we come back, I would like to talk to you about how someone might go about starting a farm-to-school program at their school, if they're, you know, whether they're a parent or a teacher. Okay?
Okay.
So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. If you've just joined us, my guest is Emily Jackson from Growing Minds, which is part of the Appalachian Sustainable Agricultural Project. And you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
Hi. I'm Gary Null, and I'm happy to be just one of the many voices speaking truth to power every day on the Progressive Radio Network. We have dozens and dozens of the finest minds in the United States, people who've spent their careers helping, first and foremost, bring justice to issues. Ralph Nader, Jimmy Dore, Gerald Salante, Utrice Lee. From all communities, we look at what is the truth. We are not right. We are not left. We're not card-carrying members of any party. We may have been at one time, but today we're just looking to how we can cut through all of the nonsense. Occam's Razor, the philosophy of cut through it and get to the truth of it. And generally, it is the most direct and honest answers, and that's what we seek. Because progressivism is to seek the truth without having to first monitor with some ideological identity. No, the truth doesn't need an ideological identity. It just needs good spokespersons to bring it to you. And we have that at the Progressive Freedom Network. We challenge Big Pharma. We challenge the big industries like Monsanto and DuPont. We challenge Wall Street and the banking community and the energy cartels, nuclear, high gas hydrofracking. We challenge all of them every day, 24/7. This is a place to come if you can handle the truth.
Does PRN inspire you? Does PRN make you want to learn more? Does PRN help you to see inside yourself, to be yourself, to grow, and to do? The truth is, we all need each other to be, to grow, and to do. So we're asking that you check out the PRN.fm.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. If you're just joining us, my guest is Emily Jackson. She's the program director of Growing Minds, which is a part of the Appalachian Sustainable Agricultural Project. And right before the break, I asked her how someone would go about starting a farm-to-school program in their state or in their school district. So, Emily, any advice for my listeners?
Oh, yes, because we want to see more and more of these grow all across the country. The best advice I would give to someone who's interested in starting this is start with the garden, because that's a constant on your school campus. It's something that you could use, you know, once it's established, it's there every day, that you can use it in different ways. And start small, you know, start with just a small little patch, maybe even start in containers if you need to. You know, for educators, we know that the gold standard is when lessons go home with children and children, you know, go home and talk about what they've done. So you want to keep that in mind in terms of replication. So if the child thinks it takes a lot of fancy equipment or a lot of money or a greenhouse or all these other things, then that replication at home is not quite as possible. So I always encourage schools and preschools to start really small, and then it's not overburdensome to the people that are implementing it either. Just start small, and maybe not even, you know, if you're in an elementary school, maybe don't try to get all the teachers involved. You know, just start with your low-hanging fruit teachers, the ones who really want to do it, and teachers are curious people, and when they see something happening and they see it's getting great attention, you know, others will want to join in, but there's always those the first few that will kind of lead the charge. And then just try to bring your community into it as well. One school I worked with, when they started a garden, they just sent home a simple flyer with all of their children asking for, you know, a hoe or a shovel or a rake. They got so much stuff donated because, you know, especially in rural communities, we have those random shovel, hoe, rake in our sheds. And they were just bombarded with all of these supplies that they then didn't have to go out and purchase.
Mm-hmm. you know, around here, we probably would get donations also, not because we're in a rural area, but more because less and less people are doing their own yard work and they're hiring people. So right. You probably get a lot of donations around here as well. But that's a good suggestion because, you know, money is always is so tight in, you know, every school district. And, you know, not having to buy that initial simple equipment would be really helpful. And then do you get into the cooking aspect of the garden? Do you do, you know, create recipes with the foods that you're growing?
Oh, absolutely. This is a, you know, once they grow the product, it's really great to then use it for, you know, creating snacks for the children and then sending that home because, you know, not all families will have the wherewithal to grow a garden or maybe even visit a farm, but all families cook at least to a certain degree. And so if you can get children excited about cooking with fresh, healthy, locally grown food, then that's a that can be a real change maker for families. You know, if a child comes home jazzed about eating some local broccoli, it's the rare parent who's not going to do whatever they can to get that kid some more broccoli. So it's a real motivating thing for parents to and for children to be the change makers, to go home and say, you know, I'm excited about this. Now let's, as a family, change our dynamics about how we eat and prepare food.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, children really can become such change makers, you know. I remember, you know, my mother, you know, was a heavy smoker. And it was, you know, her kids coming home saying, we don't want you to die. You got to stop smoking. That actually made her quit smoking.
Absolutely.
You know, kids really do have power when it comes to their parents. So don't underestimate that, everyone listening. So I know you wanted to share with us a farm story, you know, a story from your farm to school experience. You want to share that with us?
Sure. I debated whether I have a couple that are, one's just short and funny, but this one was, there's a program, a school that was, that had a summer program. So they were able to do the garden year round. So these children who were in the summer program at this elementary school were able to grow this marvelous garden, and then they decided they wanted to share it with their families. And so they invited their families to a meal, and every dish the children made, and every dish had something from the garden, even if it was just parsley or something, every dish had something from the garden. And so they laid out this really long table and invited their families. And I was sitting next to this mom, and her son was sitting across the table from us. And he just kind of, you know, said, I'm going to go get some more salad. And I didn't think anything of it. But the mother was floored. She said, well, knock me over with a feather. I can't get that child to eat salad at home for the life of me. And now here he is not only eating it, but he's going back for more. So she was just really impressed by the impact that had on her son. And what it made the Growing Minds team think about was we've scapegoated children. We've said that they won't eat healthy food. And it's really the adults around them that don't. And, you know, we've grown up with the sugar, fat, and salt and grown up not knowing how to cook, but we blame it on the children. And we really realize that if you give them a positive experience with healthy food, they are more than happy to eat it and grow it and be very happy about it.
You're so right. I actually can share a story, too, where I went into a farmer's market. You know, a few years ago, I used to go to farmers markets in economically challenged communities and volunteer, and I'd set up a table and I'd do a cooking demo. And so I was making like a jambalaya, although vegan jambalaya, not using any animal products. And, you know, I was cooking it up and it was smelling good, and all these kids were coming up wanting to try it, and many of them were there with their, not just their parents, but their grandparents, the grandmothers. And the grandmother's like, oh, no, you won't like it. And the kid's like, I want to try it. And the grandparent was saying, no, you won't like it. And I said, here, have a taste. And I'd give them, and they would love it. And then the grandparents would try it because the kid tried it. But it was amazing how many grandparents were telling them not to try it, that they wouldn't like it. And they didn't want them to waste the food. It really was shocking to me.
Yes.
And so you're so right. Very often, you know, we pass on our own dislikes to our kids and don't give them the chance to really experiment on their own.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So how does it work in actually procuring the local food for your schools? Is that a challenge? I know that, you know, in New York State it can be a challenge, you know, when school districts are asked to, you know, price things out and try to get the cheapest, you know, we know local farmers are not going to necessarily be the cheapest. So how do you work with that?
Well, we actually struggle with that a lot, mostly because of the price point. ASAP works really hard with farmers to keep them farming and keep them, you know, being able to make a living. So that's not our first go-to. Most programs around the country, that is the first go-to to try to get that local product in there. But we, you know, farmers are a big part of our constituency, and it would be slightly irresponsible of us to push them into a market that's not as economically viable as other ones that we could connect them with. So we don't put a lot of emphasis on that, and instead really focus more on the experiences around local food, the farm field trips, the cooking, the gardening. You know, of course, if opportunities come up for procurement, we work with those. A great example of that was a collective of farmers had some moon and stars melons that they were trying to sell to a market, but the moon and stars on the outside of the rind didn't quite come out. You couldn't tell it was moon and stars, and so the market didn't want them. And so we were able to have the farm sell these moon and stars heirloom watermelons to a school system that's got 26,000 kids, and they were able to get this organic watermelon at, you know, conventional watermelon prices, only because, you know, that farm was going to have to just, you know, dump them instead. So they were happy to get that other price.
Right. So I'm going to have to ask you, what is a moon and stars watermelon? I've never heard that.
Oh, maybe it's a southern variety. Probably most melons are. But, yeah, it just has markings on the outside of the rind that make you think they look like moon and star markings. So it's a red watermelon, it's a dark rind, and it has these lighter colored markings on the outside.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it was cosmetic, you know, it was just an issue of the cosmetics didn't meet the grade, but the product itself was fine. You know, it was wonderful and tasty, but that outside rind didn't say moon and stars, and so the market, the grocery didn't want to buy them.
Mm-hmm. I was actually able this year to pre-contract with a farmer to grow butternut squash for our school district. And so it was a field that they actually were not planning on planting. They're just going to let it go fallow for the year. And instead, they planted 600 pounds of butternut squash for us. And, you know, and we bought it at a fair price, and it was, you know, a win-win for our school district to get some organic butternut squash in there, and it worked out for the farmer, too. So, yep. You know, that's how I've been able to get around that a little bit, but it's still cheap. Yep. It still was more money, I think, than buying it from a conventional distributor. I'm not sure, but
well, right now we have in COVID times, we've got some funding to purchase food from local farmers. And again, we work with, you know, 800 plus farmers in our service area, and we're purchasing the product from them at a fair market price and making that food available, connecting those farmers with local food relief agencies, as well as Head Starts and senior dining sites in our service area. So we're calling that project Appalachian Farms Feeding Families. And we've just kind of really got it going because we're just, you know, starting the growing season off to a really good start. So we're making those connections and getting that product. You know, farmers need income now and people need food. So we've been making that happen over the last couple of months.
And where'd that funding come from? A grant or from the state or where?
We got it from a couple of grants, a couple of North Carolina-based grant funds to make that happen. And, yeah, it's been wonderful.
Uh-huh. That's great. And what has your organization done to help institutionalize farm to school?
Well, about 10 years ago, we started working with teacher education programs and dietetic intern programs. We called it Growing Minds at University. So we were, instead of relying on the teacher that's already in the classroom or that nutritionist who is the school nutrition director who's already out there, we thought we would go upstream and embed local food and farm to school instruction and practices and experiences into the dietetic program and into the pre-service teacher training programs. And so now we've, in the last year, we've also added community colleges because that's where the folks go for the early childhood educators, get their certifications usually through community colleges. And we have 58 community colleges in North Carolina, and right now 22 are embedding farm to preschool into their early childhood programs.
Oh, that's unbelievable. That's great.
We're excited. I mean, that we picked those two, the dietitian, the future RDs, registered dietitians, and the teacher as the two stakeholders who really have a lot of impact, you know, on food environments for children.
Uh-huh. And so what does the training consist of? Teaching them how to start a garden or the lesson plans that connected? I mean, obviously the lesson plans are so different when you're dealing with preschool versus middle school or high school, even elementary school. How do you adjust for that?
Well, the preschool, we've created a lot of early childhood programs at the community college level are online, which actually makes them made them very COVID ready. And so we created videos that spell out, you know, the four components of farm to preschool, farm to school. We have tons of lesson plans. We have things called Farm to Preschool Goes Home. We've got presentations. We have menu templates. We also took all of our lesson plans for early childhood or integrated or aligned with the curriculum standards, and we also, preschools are very aware and work towards a star rating system, like a 3-star, 4-star, 5-star, and so what we did was we aligned farm to preschool with that star rating system, so it shows you if you do these activities, you can increase your star rating, which helps get them more money, so it's a great win-win situation. So we've had many years to gather up a lot of information for the early childhood instructors to then share with their students. And then the dietetic interns, we work with three universities, Appalachian State, Western Carolina, and Lenoir Ryan University. And we have they give us a day-long training for those students. And then once they're out in their dietetic rotations, we provide some minimal funding for them if they're interested in taking the hospital staff on a farm field trip or a tour of the farmer's market, or they want to do a taste test in the hospital cafeteria. So we're kind of there as a ongoing support system for them. as well as we serve as a preceptor or a host for a dietetic intern as well every year.
Ah, lovely. Now, are these lesson plans available to the public, like, you know, a teacher in New York, if they wanted to learn how to do that, do they have access to that, or is it something that you have to purchase or sign up for? How does that work?
Everything is free and available on our website to anybody, and we've got people from all around the world that use our resources. And if you want, like, the Farm to Preschool Toolkit, if you want a nice little, you know, printed nicely on nice paper, you can, you know, purchase that from us, but it's also free completely to download, you know, on your own. Because we, you know, we just want these resources to be out there and people using them. And so we make everything we do pretty much available for free.
That's so wonderful. What a great service you're doing. That's just so great. So where do you get your funding? Through donations, through grants? How do you survive?
Mostly grants. We stay pretty busy writing grants, but we also do some earned income, you know, through we put out a local food guide, and so we sell advertising for that, and people have to pay to be in it. We do some consulting. So we do some earned income things. We do, you know, get donations. We're very appreciative of all of our donors. And Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation of North Carolina is one of our major funders at the moment. And we've just been working with them for years and years and years, and they just really believe in us and support our work, and it's marvelous.
Oh, that is wonderful. Well, I will share all your links on my website, and maybe you can share with my listening audience how to get in touch with you or your website so that they can go directly as well. And and we can maybe generate some funds for you as well. So
that'd
please
be great.
Share.
The best way to get, you know, to get in touch with us is just through our website, which is growing-minds.org. And, you know, you can just go through all of our resources. We separate our resources out into the four components. And then, you know, on our lesson plans page, we have the Growing Minds Day by Day that you mentioned earlier. And if you don't see something, we recently added an equity and inclusion diversity page for resources for teachers about teaching about anti-racism and how to incorporate that into your curriculum. So that's a new page that we just put up. It's on our lesson plan page.
Perfect.
Yeah,
it's hard to adjust to all the changes on such a, you know, quick basis, but you're really doing it. I know, you know, that's a challenge for everybody, getting everything up online and adjusting to, you know, the time. So we are living in really unusual times, and I just want to thank you, Emily, so much for your inspiration and your hard work and your dedication to the children of our future. So thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
You're welcome. And everyone listening, we've been talking with Emily Jackson from Growing Minds. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'll see you all again next week. Have a great weekend.